If you'd like to receive this podcast early and without ads, consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Listeners to this show can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience and early access, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, and an invitation to join the DSR Slack community. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code NOJOKE to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code NOJOKE. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, April 6th, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. This week, the New York Times reported that Donald Trump privately spoke with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is effectively Saudi Arabia's leader. At the same time, Trump's private business dealings with the Saudis seem to be going gangbusters on multiple fronts. And, of course, Trump will be the GOP nominee for president, which means the Saudis would have strong incentives to, shall we say, remain in his good graces. All this raises all sorts of opportunities for corruption that Congress arguably should be trying to shed light on right at this moment. One lawmaker who has been calling for this in a sustained way is Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, ranking Democrat on the Oversight Committee. So we invited him on the show. Congressman, we know Trump privately spoke with Mohammed, but we don't know what was discussed. What sort of concerns should this raise in the eyes of Congress?
Trump, like Mohammed bin Salman, doesn't acknowledge any distinction between his private business affairs and the affairs of state. When he was in office, he was openly doing millions and millions of dollars of business with foreign governments. They were also setting up billion-dollar deals for afterwards, as Jared Kushner brought back $2 billion to manage from the Saudi Sovereign National Fund. They share the basic foreign policy consensus of the world's autocrats and kleptocrats and plutocrats and dictators. Sometimes I think that Donald Trump's public policy is Russia first, and sometimes I think it's Saudi Arabia first, but it all comes down to the same thing. I mean, in terms of geopolitics, he will always be counted on to be working with Putin and Orban and Xi and LCC and, all the autocrats and dictators, Erdogan, the strongmen like Netanyahu. But when it comes to his private business affairs, then of course Saudi Arabia is his touchstone.
So let's talk about the state of Trump's business dealings with the Saudis. You mentioned Jared Kushner's success in bringing in a $2 billion investment from a Saudi fund. Trump's businesses are shifting towards his golf resorts, which are benefiting from hosting tournaments for the Saudi-sponsored LIV Golf League. There's another Trump organization deal with a Saudi firm for a development in Oman. Now, you recently released a report that found that Trump's businesses pocketed at least $7.8 million in payments from foreign governments during his presidency. More than $615,000 of that came from Saudi Arabia. Now that all these deals are going on currently, what should Congress really want to know about these deals?
If you look at the Trump administration's tilt to Saudi Arabia in the last administration, it's really striking. In the Yemen war, the Trump administration was all over Mohammed bin Salman and Saudi Arabia's side. In that terrible, desperate war that destroyed a lot of civilian life. When you look at the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, who was a Saudi-born American journalist working with the Washington Post, He was drawn and quartered, dismembered by members of basically the Saudi secret police, who report ultimately to Mohammed bin Salman. And as Donald Trump bragged to several people, he saved his posterior, although he didn't put it quite like that. But he took credit basically for rescuing and salvaging Mohammed bin Salman at a time when he was an international pariah. You know, when you look at any of the internal human rights violations that have taken place in Saudi Arabia, including when MBS jailed members of his own family and imprisoned them, made them prisoners. Admittedly, I think it was in the Four Seasons or some fancy hotel, but he basically removed them from their homes and put them away. Donald Trump stood with them. Saudi Arabia is one of the leading administrators of the death penalty. It doesn't allow political parties, it doesn't allow independent newspapers. It's an authoritarian state with very strong hallmarks of totalitarianism in it. And of course, it's also been fomenting Wahhabism and anti-Semitism all over the world through various schools that it sponsors and funds. So, you know, the Trump administration was openly entangled with them. And, you know, perhaps we don't want to overstate how much all of his financial deals and sucking up to the Saudis influenced all of those things. He'd probably do it anyway, because that's his basic inclination, to stand with the authoritarians. But at this point, he's utterly entangled with Saudi Arabia, personally, in a familial sense, politically, and he stands with the authoritarian governments, and that is his basic business model. They're looking for ways where they can have businesses that are just completely funded by authoritarian governments, and they don't have to engage in any of the market relationships that anybody else would in a free market society, right? So they give Saudi Arabia whatever they want when they're in power, then they walk off like Jared Kushner did with a $2 billion plus investment, despite the fact that the independent advisors to the Saudi Sovereign National Fund said it was a bad bet and Jared Kushner wasn't qualified to get all that money. They were overridden by Mohammed bin Salman, who said no, he wanted to do that for his friends in the Trump family. And so that's like a $25 or $30 million payment a year that Jared Kushner gets just for having tilted Middle East foreign policy towards Saudi interests at every turn. That's their business model, and it's their political model at the same time.
Right. So what do we want to know about the private call that Trump had with the Crown Prince?
Well, what other deals are being cut on behalf of the Trump family with Saudi interests around the world? How much is Saudi Arabia dictating the course of the new Gulf Corporation in America? You know, as there's been this move to take over American Gulf, what exactly is the Saudi role, and how is Donald Trump profiting from that? And what sorts of promises are being made for the next administration? What is Trump pledging to do for Saudi Arabia? And given the nightmare of politics in the Middle East today, we need to know exactly what more concessions and deals are being offered to the Saudis.
President Biden is negotiating a deal between the U.S., the Saudis, and Israel. The Times reporting notes that if Biden does reach some kind of agreement with them, Trump would be in a position to either get congressional Republicans to block the deal or get them to support that deal. So a big question, it seems to me, for all of us, including members of Congress, is whether Trump might be somehow trying to undermine Biden's foreign policy dealings or making promises to the Saudis for what he'd give them alternatively if reelected president. Is that something that Congress should be taking an active interest in?
Absolutely. Well, we just saw that happen, Greg, when the president sent us his foreign aid policy package of humanitarian aid to Gaza and Ukraine, strategic military aid to Israel, $61 billion to the people of Ukraine fighting off Putin's filthy imperialist invasion and war on democracy in Ukraine, and also several billion to the Indo-Pacific allies of America. And then the GOP said, well, no, we can't defend the border in Ukraine, or we can't defend the border in Israel unless we're going to defend the border in the United States. And so the Democrats and Republicans in the Senate got together and over a period of several months hammered out a hard-won compromise, which not only the Democrats, but the Republicans were willing to go along with it. And McConnell said he would support it. Senator Lankford, perhaps the most conservative Republican there is, he said he would go along with it. And so there was set to be a deal, and then it got vetoed by the fourth branch of government, Donald Trump, and the fifth branch of government, Vladimir Putin. So you had Trump blowing it up because, of course, he didn't want any kind of border solution, you know, no matter its merits. He wanted, and he wants, a border crisis. I mean, that's all he's got left. I mean, abortion, they can't talk about anymore because the whole country is so thoroughly rejected their anti-abortion, anti-woman program there. So they can't talk about that. And so it's basically down to immigration. So he didn't want it. And in the meantime, you got Vladimir Putin breathing down his neck saying, no, you don't let that package go through with $61 billion going to the people of Ukraine.
Right. So Donald Trump exerts immense power over the Republican Party position, unprecedented power, really, for a former president or a nominee, as he is. And so it's not theoretical, right? We don't have to theorize about it. He can actually stop Republicans from agreeing to one policy or another. And
so, I mean, I see Republicans in committee or on the floor taking phone calls from Donald Trump.
It's an amazing thing. But so it seems to me that there's sort of opportunities for corruption here that are really off the charts. And so, okay, the House doesn't have subpoena power, but Democrats control the Senate, and that gives them subpoena power. What theoretically could be accomplished with subpoena power right now in terms of looking into all this? Is there a legitimate basis for wanting to know about Trump's private dealings with the Saudis? What does that all look like?
Well, the truth is that the House and the Senate Democrats are equivalently situated right now to ask the questions. We can send letters and we can demand answers. The reason I say that is because Donald Trump won't answer any subpoena, and he's made that very clear. And as we've seen in all of these criminal cases, he will fight everything and drag everything out. But it is critical for us to be asking these questions, even if we really know what the answers are. Of course, he's in bed with Mohammed bin Salman, just like he's in bed with Vladimir Putin. You know, on the geopolitical side, he's completely in bed with Mohammed bin Salman in terms of all of his private deal making. But we need to know specifically, what are all of these deals and how do they affect the geopolitical dimension? Because Mohammed bin Salman, he's literally a killer and he's nobody's fool. He's going to get whatever he can out of Donald Trump.
So what theoretically could we be seeing from subpoena power here? What could theoretically be accomplished with an aggressive investigation? What could we learn?
Well, again, I don't want to put too many eggs in the subpoena basket right now. Of course, on the House side, we don't have the subpoena power. So we do write a lot of letters setting forth the questions that we have to lay the groundwork for having the subpoena power later. And in the Senate side, you know, some of my Senate colleagues are a little gun shy about trying to use the subpoena power because it always ends up in the Senate to enforce, in the full Senate to enforce the subpoena. And there, because of the filibuster rules, you need 60 senators to go along with it. So, I mean, they're theoretically in a better place than we are to get answers to some of these questions. But when it comes down to it, they don't really have the subpoena enforcement power because they're not able ordinarily to get 60 votes for these things. And remember, the GOP is getting more and more extreme and more sycophantic to Donald Trump as people leave.
I do wonder, though, whether if these subpoenas were put out and if the they were defied, the Senate could hold full votes on enforcing them, and that would force Republican senators to vote to protect Donald Trump from transparency. And that seems like it would be a valuable thing in and of itself, because as we all know, that type of activity draws media attention and scrutiny mm-hmm. and lets people know that there's a problem. I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we only have the most skeletal outline of, you know, what exactly Jared Kushner's up to, for example, with respect to Saudi Arabia. We've gotten some kinds of information about the Saudi offensive to take over World Golf and to try to buy up the tournaments and buy up the players. And we know that there are Trump golf courses that have been getting a lot of business as part of that effort. But we would ask for all documents that explain what all of these relationships really are, so at least we can have clarity about them. You know, we also need to know on the other side what kinds of promises Donald Trump and his various family members are making to Mohammed bin Salman about the next administration, about arms sales, about international arrangements and treaties and alliances and so on. Again, you know, the outlines of it are very clear. Donald Trump, you know, has said he wants to be dictator on day one. He's got his Project 2025, which is all about turning us into an authoritarian society. I mean, he wants to create camps for undocumented immigrants and round up millions of people and then have massive deportations going on. He wants to repeal birthright citizenship, which is in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Then he wants to essentially turn hundreds of thousands or even millions of federal workers all over the country into political appointees. So they're directly responsible to him and they would not have any civil service protections. He's talking about issuing a mass pardon to the people he calls the January 6th hostages, which is a complete desecration of that word and an insult to the families of real hostages, like the families of the 130 plus people are still being held by Hamas. A hostage, as you know, is someone who's been illegally abducted by a terrorist or criminal entity and held for a legal or financial or political ransom. These people aren't hostages. They are U.S. citizens who pled guilty overwhelmingly to violently assaulting federal officers. And you know, he's talking about freeing them. So that's all part of the program. You know, to have those pardoned political shock troops added to Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort and Roger Stone and Dinesh D'Souza, the other supplicants to Donald Trump who've been pardoned and now are part of his political operation. I mean, you know, so look, these are all things we want to know about. And the most obscure connections, though, of course, are the foreign ones, where so much of it takes place behind closed doors. A subpoena is necessary, but it's not even sufficient, as we know, because Donald Trump showed in the last administration how he would just blow off subpoenas. It took us years to get the information from Mazars that allowed us to put out the report that you referenced, Greg, about foreign government emoluments. But even that just scratched the surface because we were only able to get 2 years of the 4 years of his administration. We were only able to look at four of his more than 500 businesses, and we only got records on 20 countries, where there are 170 countries on Earth. And we know there were a lot more than 20 that were depositing their bribes at the Trump Hotel, which I call the Washington Emolument.
The Washington Emolument, yes. Can I ask, do we think that the U.S. government may know more about Trump's conversations with the Saudis than we do, and may know more about whether he's undermining current U.S. policy?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I could, you know, I would really want to check with my colleagues on the House Foreign Affairs Committee about that to see whether they think the information is available. You know, and what's important about the line of questioning that you're suggesting, Greg, is that we understand that Donald Trump wants to make alliances with all of the authoritarian powers on Earth, whether it's Xi or Kim Jong-un or Putin or Orban, you name it. I mean, these are his heroes, these are his friends. But it would be good to know if we could fill in the blanks in terms of the very specific commitments that he's making right now. And he has emissaries who are traveling all over the world to make common cause with right-wing governments. And those people are doing everything they can to try to make Donald Trump look good and to aid his campaign in the same way that Vladimir Putin very clearly did in 2016 and 2020.
Congressman, if the American people deliver the House to Democrats this fall, next year, do you think Democrats will pursue all these things? You have said that you would love to fill in more about the emoluments, and then there are all these questions about what Trump is promising to various autocrats and the Saudis right now. Is that stuff you will pursue if the American people give you Congress?
Absolutely. I mean, we need the factual details set forth so people understand the struggle in our century between one public philosophy, which says that the U.S. government has got to be an instrument for the common good of all the people, which is why we're investing in infrastructure and reducing prescription drug costs and disaster relief. That's what the Democratic vision is, versus Donald Trump first philosophy, which is that the government is really an instrument for self-enrichment and money-making for the guy who gets in and his companies and his family. I mean, those are two radically opposed conceptions of what government is for.
Well, it'll certainly be interesting to see what you're able to uncover if you do get the House back. Congressman Raskin, thank you so much for coming on with us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Greg.
You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.